Lauren Manning was a senior vice president at Cantor Fitzgerald working in Tower 2 of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. The fireball from the explosion caused extensive burns on 82% of her body, but she escaped the building and is one of the few survivors from her company. She's recounted her story of that day and of her long recovery in a memoir called Unmeasured Strength. It's published by Henry Holt. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Leonard.
Had you always wanted to write, or is this something that was forced on you?
No, I think certainly in addition to grocery lists and many things that were work-related, reading the written word and putting pen to paper is something I've always enjoyed doing. And so a series of collected notes over the years, and after the birth of our second son, it seemed to make sense.
Did you see the plane hit the building?
I was in the building when the first plane hit the building and felt the seismic shock of it, and the fuel descended down the elevator bank and blew out over me.
You had just arrived in the lobby.
Yes, I had.
So this was almost immediate. The fuel came down probably within seconds as a fireball?
Yes, I think it was in under a second. These vast shafts that held many, many elevators left an open passageway, and so it descended with great fury and blew out, and I was engulfed in it. And immediately, in that surreal moment, tried to figure out, you know, what is happening and what can I do to try to escape it.
Well, you're right about making a conscious decision to live while you were on fire. Wouldn't anyone make that decision?
No, I don't think so, for a number of reasons. When you are engulfed in flames and the absolute pain is something that can literally and did attempt to literally pull me under, you have to fight your way through it, just as many of us do with illness and tragedy when they confront. There was an active decision that I had to make, and I did.
An exercise of willpower.
Absolutely. I saw a vision of my son, and even though I think going under and death may have provided some relief in some way, it was not my path. It's not the one I chose.
A bystander helped you that morning. What did he do?
Well, as I fled across the highway to the elevator bank and dropped to roll, there were some people that came across to try to aid the few that had made it out. And so he helped me as I was rolling to put out the flames. And I was there for about 50 minutes before finally, with his assistance, walked what seemed an interminable length to an EMS truck across the highway.
Were you the only one who had been engulfed in the flames?
No, I had walked in the building initially and seen two women to my right who, as I turned to move out, were covered in flames as well. And there were many, you know, there were people struggling to get out of the building. And as I looked across the street, you know, people were coming out from various places, ground floor and much higher heights. But as I lay on that bank and looked across it, the few that were there were motionless not long after.
It's such an incredible traumatic thing to happen. And most people resist revisiting awful things that they've experienced. You say you took notes over the years?
No, I didn't take active notes in terms of let me put this to paper how I'm feeling at the moment. There were times of joy and some difficult times, and so almost as an exercise and just putting down what I felt on a particular day, I would do that periodically. And it was difficult at times to write it, but it was also beautiful to get the words finally on paper.
And I'm sure you've told the story many, many times. Has it gotten any easier with repetition?
You know, life is full of challenges, and I had to file away that day very succinctly what happened and move forward. I got dealt a tough hand, and I had to take it and run with it. And so it's a story that when people ask, you know, I moved through it and moved beyond what really mattered, which was finding really strength I felt I might have had, wasn't really sure of. And hopefully people can identify their own strength in times of turmoil.
When you first arrived at St. Vincent's Hospital, what was the doctor's prognosis?
Not good. It was, I had near zero odds. At best, I had 18% based on the calculation of the extent of the burn, and I had many other complications, but it was a very dire situation, and the burn continued to plunge deeper and deeper, and it would be months before I was stabilized.
You were cooking, in effect?
Yes, on a slow boil, as it were.
Why did you wind up at St. Vincent's? I would have thought that Beekman Hospital was a lot closer. Today, this would not even be possible because they've closed down St. Vincent's.
Yeah, St. Vincent's is, being a West Villager, was an integral part of our neighborhood, and certainly my husband and my son and myself have all paid visits there, and I was remarking on the way down, it was very sad to see its shuttered doors. When you're evacuated, I wasn't telling them where to go. There was a truckload of people, and I was probably on the bottom of the list, and that's where I ended up. I was pleased to get there, and I was pleased, obviously, to eventually end up at a specialized center where I needed to be.
Because St. Vincent's didn't have a burn center, but New York Presbyterian does?
Yes, they have a specialized center for burns, as many hospitals do for different issues.
So how long after you were at St. Vincent's were you moved to New York Presbyterian?
I was at St. Vincent's until early that evening when a wonderful doctor on St. Vincent's staff who had treated my husband for a compound fracture of his finger saw my situation and realized that I would not be checking out unless I got out and got to people that could adequately help me.
Well, how did they treat you in the first place? Did they just pack you in ice?
I wasn't analyzing what they were doing, but they were calling for protocol to the other hospital and a social worker. They were doing the best they could, and I applaud their efforts. A social worker went and prayed in the chapel, and then she left and went out onto the street and said amongst many that were standing out there wanting to help, "Are there any burn nurses here?" And two women that were on holiday volunteered and came in, and they came up, and they said to my husband, "Now we're going to get to work on her, and if you'd step out, we're going to start treating her."
A lot of people just came through, which gives us a feeling that there is a strong sense of community. I was just talking about that with Joel Meyerowitz in New York City. Many of these, you probably would have been in worse shape if people just hadn't suddenly stepped forward.
I think that's who we are as human beings, ultimately. And when you sift through all the vagaries of what people do and don't do on a daily basis in times of trouble and natural disaster, I think we all turn to try to help one another.
Your son Tyler was about a year old at that time. Was he able to connect to you when you were all bandaged up?
It was certainly why I fought in many ways to make it. And I remember that day, November 17th, when I was finally permitted to see him again. I was really hopeful and incredibly afraid that he would not recognize me. I looked so radically different. And I asked my dad to pick up some perfume that I'd worn occasionally. And he came down the hallway, my little boy, who's now pushing a toy, and it took a few moments, but he recognized me, and a smile spread across his face, and to this day, it was probably the best day in my life. He recognized me, and we were back together.
Well, he's now 11.
Yep.
So
a few short weeks.
So you had to explain what had happened. How old was he before you could explain something so terrible to him?
I think it was an iterative situation where bits and pieces fell together. He would ask questions, and he certainly knew that I was his mom. And I said, everybody looks different. No one's perfect. And, I can do anything any other mom can, and I love you. And so he found out as a matter of course. We didn't force anything on him. And he understands there are good guys and bad guys. There always will be.
How long before you were able to return home, even though obviously you couldn't return to normal for quite a while.
I returned home 6 months and 4 days after I left for the office that morning. Mm. Mm.
My guest is Lauren Manning. Her book, Unmeasured Strength, is published by Henry Holt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Coming up in the next hour, Alexandra Styron describes growing up the daughter of the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer William Styron. And we'll also take a look at how architects have been approaching security concerns since 9/11. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from the International Center of Photography, presenting Remembering 9/11, a five-part photography exhibition presented in collaboration with the National September 11th Memorial Museum, September 9th, 2011 to January 8th, 2012. More at icp.com. Channel 13, presenting Andrea Bocelli and the New York Philharmonic. Bocelli will perform in Central Park on September 15th. Tickets are required. More at 13.org. TechServe, presenting the TechServe Trade-In Program, which accepts old computers, cell phones, or mobile devices. TechServe, the Apple specialist on 23rd Street, or TechServe.com.
We're back with Lauren Manning, who's a former managing director and partner at Cantor Fitzgerald, and her story of surviving the 9/11 attacks has been featured on Oprah, on NBC's Today, and many other media outlets around the world. CNN recently chose her as one of the most intriguing newsmakers of the past 25 years, and she has written a memoir called Unmeasured Strength, which is published by Henry Holt. And in the book, you call your physical therapy and other recuperative treatments your job. That's why you looked upon it?
Yes, it absolutely was my job. You know, 7 days a week for many hours a day. Having been thrust into such a different life in such a radical way, I figured out pretty quickly after I was finally able to interact with my doctors that I had a 24-month window, and that was going to be my best shot to get the most back, and so I took it and ran with it.
And how many operations did you wind up having?
I don't know, countless. You know, there's certain numbers that are worth keeping track of. That's not one of them.
Your face is remarkably unscarred. How many plastic surgery operations have you had?
Not on my face. The scars are there.
This is the original skin. They didn't have to.
No, I have a tissue expander right in my lower neck, and that was it. Sometimes the face can, they say, look the worst and heal the best, and you know, it's a matter of genetics, and you know, maybe you need stronger glasses. I don't know.
Maybe, but no. Yeah, I mean, I guess if I started really seriously searching your face, I might see there were some anomalies. But
that's age.
Do you look different than you did before?
No, I think comparatively speaking to those that make liberal use and, you know, whatever you need to do in life to feel good about yourself in terms of surgeries or injectables, that's great. But no, I look like I've aged. And I'm older, and I look a little different, but I look like me. And
did you get psychological care?
No. And I think in 93, I had a very clear understanding that I felt that they would come back for us. And, it's the way I was raised, I think. You know, things happen, you've got to get over it. And I had no delusions or illusions. You know, there's a very basic cognitive situation in life. You get dealt a hand, you got to figure it out. And no matter how hard it is, no matter how dire, if you choose to step forward, you've won something. If not the overall prize, you've won a relative peace. And that's what I sought to do.
You'd worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. Was the company supportive during your hospital stay?
Yes. Certainly the company had been torn to tatters. My husband went back, went to help rebuild them, and I did what I could to basically stand in for so many of my friends and colleagues that never had that that chance that I was blessed to get. And, you know.
Well, most of the employees died on that
right,
day.
Right, exactly.
Were you able to talk to the families of the ones who didn't survive?
I was very fortunate in 2002 to have an opportunity to speak at the Cantor Fitzgerald Memorial, and it was my chance, and it has been every year since, to communicate with the families and tell them of how much I loved, you know, their sons and daughters or wives or husbands that I had worked with.
Mr. Lutnick has been painted as both a hero and a villain in some instances. He stopped paying salaries to his dead and missing employees very soon after 9/11, and many said too soon. What do you think about this now, and what did you think about it when you first learned about it?
I mean, I was in an induced coma for almost 2 months, and so much of what transpired happened when I simply wasn't part of the scenario. You know, I know Howard personally. He's a dear friend, and his family are wonderful people. You know, it was obvious what had happened. He has been a stalwart supporter of the families, and
he's given them money now.
I'm a survivor. I've been very fortunate. He has done the right thing, and I stand by him and all those that have worked tirelessly to support those in need.
You now have another son. Did you always want to have several children?
Yes. One point in my early, very feminist life, I thought, why would I even want children? And then on the day that my first son was born, I realized that I'd never seen and felt such happiness. And we certainly had always thought, Greg and I, that we wanted another child. And it was something I thought we'd never be able to do after 9/11. And we tried for years and much frustration and disappointment. And then finally, miraculously, we welcomed our second son, Jagger Thomas, almost 2 years ago in October.
Well, you'd had difficulty getting pregnant with Tyler, so you must have been even more concerned that what you'd gone through was going to make it more difficult to become pregnant another time.
It was, you know, with Tyler, to get technical, because many couples go through this, you know, my embryos were great. It was an age thing, you know, when you make a trade, when you have a career and you've prioritized other things, and that trade oftentimes means you need help to get through it. I was able to try again afterward, and it just wasn't working out. My body rebelled, and so eventually we were referred to and sought the help of a carrier, and they're wonderful people. They do
Tyler and Jagger are rock names. Is there any significance in that?
One would think so. No.
Isn't your husband in a band that plays Rolling Stones material?
I know, you would never believe it, right? It's true, though. You know, we admire Mick Jagger, and he's actually very generous in writing a beautiful note when Oprah let him know what had happened to us, and Greg has a lovely guitar from him. But no, we just thought it was a good, strong name, and Tyler, it just seemed right, and so it is.
You and Greg were having some disagreements about his career choices before 9/11. He was also in the financial services industry and wanted to become a writer.
Yes, Greg that day, he worked at Eurobrokers, and he was on an impact floor, and through fate, we both miraculously have a son who's not an orphan. He loves, you know, he loved writing, and he had always thought, although he had a successful career, to make that turn in the road. And so we were having some disagreements over really charting the course of a journalist starting out, vis-a-vis...
Wanting to have a new family.
Yeah, with where we were in our lives, and, you know, it wasn't like we were, 18, 20 years old. We've gotten a little settled.
And you wound up being the writer.
Well, Greg is a beautiful writer, and he wrote a wonderful book that was derived from a series of emails called Love, Greg and Lauren, which was basically a shout-out to friends of what was going on with me during those very early days. And, yes, I have become a writer, a recorder of my thoughts and words, I most likely think, and that is...
So this is it? You don't think you'll be doing much more writing?
No, I've actually No, I'm actually writing in a very rapid manner much these days. And so we'll see what the future holds. Anything is possible.
In the book, you talk about how angry you were when you learned that the towers had been purposely attacked by terrorists. Did you follow the news about the war in Afghanistan while you were recuperating? Were you able to?
I certainly had a big job on my plate, and you know, I was tangentially aware of what was going on, and the efforts, you know, on behalf of those that had, you know, been hit, of those military men and women to stamp out a cancer that, although isn't prevalent, exists, and it's never a good thing to hit innocents.
Well, have you become more politicized as a result? Because this has politicized a lot of people, as we've seen in all the various controversies swirling around the site. There were arts institutions that were originally planned that have now been rejected because there were fears that somewhere down the line they might have an exhibit that was, I don't know, that some people would take offense by. The families have disagreed on what should be going there and what shouldn't. An architect was replaced and a new one designed the building that we're now seeing. There was the mosque nearby that's caused so much controversy.
You know, I let the experts decide those things. I think the ability, you know, art and the human experience and what we all believe is beautiful or right is relative. And I think much of the decisions have been made by consensus, and so I leave it to others.
Meanwhile, you see yourself as a spokesperson for burn victims?
I don't see myself as a spokesperson for anything other than the human will to understand that, you know, we all at some point in our lives are wounded by illness, violence, or tragedy, and although we can be touched by it, we can refuse to be held by it, and I hope that I have exemplified that at least to my family and those that have supported me. We move on.
Have you gone back to work?
I've been at work for many years in recovering, and certainly...
Well, you said that was your job, but I mean, Kent Fitzgerald or some other...
I mean, I remain active. My licenses are active, and, you know, I've kept my hand in various things, but no, I think I'm finally, you know, starting a new chapter in my life and seeing where it leads me.
And writing new chapters as well.
As it were, yes.
And are you living in the same place in the village?
No, we, as I write in the book, it wasn't large to begin with, and we remained there for many years. The river was very, very healing for me, and the beauty of the neighborhood. But we finally moved on and got a little more space and a few years ago.
And you have an event that's taking place at the Barnes & Noble store on 86th Street.
Yes, September 19th. I'll be doing a reading and a book signing at the Barnes & Noble up at 86th and Lexington.
And that's at 7 o'clock.
Yes, I believe it is.
And meanwhile, we have this book called Unmeasured Strength, written by Lauren Manning and published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.